So here it is, towards the end of March, right at the spring equinox, and find myself back at Abhayagiri after having been in the UK, England, Chithurst and Amaravati for the past 4 months, almost 5 months. Been back here in the States for just about 2 weeks now. As I think most everybody in the room knows, maybe not everybody, but most everybody, I had to come back unexpectedly for some health issues needed to be managed here rather than over there. And it was all very unexpected. As most people know, I was planning to be there for at least 1 year and helping Lungpa Pasana, who's now there, take on the role of helping him take on the role of senior monk while Ajahn Amaro goes on a sabbatical for a year. Lungpa committed to be there for at least through after towards the end of this year, and I was planning to stay there to help him out as the ways that I can until he returns, returning to go to Thailand and then come back to Abhayagiri at the end of the year. And then I had the potential of staying on for another year after that because my visa is a 2-year visa. So had spent a lot of time before leaving in November, at least 6 months really of a lot of planning that had to go into it to get the visas for both myself and Lungpa, the special visas and all the plans that had to be made and the arrangements that needed to be booked into and various issues to wrap up here, both for himself and for myself, various appointments and whatnot. And spent quite a bit of time orienting myself and shifting my whole perceptual status to being away for possibly up to 2 years. And then arriving there in November and getting settled at Chithurst for about 5 weeks or so before heading up to Amaravati in the early part of December to get settled there and get things set up for Lungpa's arrival in late January. Getting all sorts of, meeting the people, getting to know the people, getting to know the structures, and Amaravati was in a big transition at that time, opening their new sala and closing off the temporary structures that they had used, so there was a lot of activity going on around that. And setting up all the resources, the healthcare resources for both myself and Lungpa, and not to mention all the practicalities of receiving a very senior monk, paving the way. So lots of time spent on getting to know the systems and the various players, the structures at Amaravati as well as in England. And it's interesting to see just the whole way that the perceptual patterns get programmed with that kind of level of attention to detail and immersion in another culture, another place. And then, as it turns out, I had a vague notion that there was this underlying health condition from just a few days before I left to go to England. I had to go to a doctor's visit because I had a pretty bad head and chest cold and needed some antibiotics, and in the process was told that I had a heart murmur that needed to be looked at and taken care of. And in the flurry of leaving in a few days, I more or less dismissed it, but kept it in the back of my mind to get something to get checked out when I got to England, which I did finally when I got up to Amaravati, not until late December, getting an appointment. And then found out after a series of appointments and machinations to try and figure out what was going on that there's a leaky valve in my heart that needs to be repaired sooner rather than later. And all the questions and consults and appointments and waiting and research and all of that happening at the same time. I was helping Lumpa get settled and establishing our time there. And so all of that happening, and then realizing over a period of time, was by mid-February or so, that it was early to mid-February, that it was looking like I really need to come back to Ubud Giri to get this taken care of rather than doing it over in England. And have found myself, now that I'm back here, of course I'm always glad to be here, but struggling with just some perceptual disorientation, because the amount of time spent creating this whole world of plans and expectations and ideas about what's going to be happening for the next year to 2 years, and then engaging in implementing that, making that happen, creating all the environmental conditions to make that possible, create a very strong perceptual image in my mind of where I was, what I was doing, you know, my role, in a sense, you know, defining myself along those lines that had been in planning and implementing for such a long and intense period of time. And all of a sudden finding myself back on a plane, you know, heading towards California again, and landing here and getting reacquainted, resettled, extremely warmly welcomed, and everything's on one level quite familiar, because it's only been 5 months that I've been gone, 4.5, 5 months, but still with the momentum of the perceptual conditioning of the past year, essentially, playing a very strong role in my world. And it's starting to change a little bit now, but these first couple of weeks, it's been disorienting in some ways. Mixed perceptions of life at Amaravati and all the energy that went in, and juxtaposed with the fact that I'm climbing up and down the Ubud Giri Hills once again, and the people are, mostly familiar, but from memory, and where are all the people that I've been spending the past 5 months with? You know, they're in the memory, very strong memory, but trying to mix the two experiences together is a real perceptual trip, really. So I've been reflecting on that and, you know, reestablishing my ground in the present moment, awareness, realizing, of course, that all these perceptual experiences are just that much. But they're still impactful, even though I don't necessarily need to cling to them as a reality, you know, an ultimate reality, and can step back and see them as they arise and pass away. They have a quite a strength to them. And it's just, I think, important to realize and to reflect on how this is a pattern that these perceptual patterns are how we all live our lives, in a sense. And the conceptual patterns, the conceiving that we employ to support the world as we see it, the world as we experience it, to keep that sense of familiarity and predictability there. We use the conceiving mind to keep steering us in the direction that supports those perceptions. There's the often quoted comment from the Buddha of forever. For however it is conceived, it will always be other than that. So that's a good time to reflect on that, that no matter how we conceive of something to be, the energy, the mental energy that we put into something, it's going to be different than what our expectations and what our conceiving mind can do. It's a great phrase because it's multi-layered, I think. On the obvious level, I think, the more obvious level, for however we conceive it, it will always be other than that. You know, points to no matter what energy and time and abstraction we put into creating thoughts and ideas that support our perceptual realm, the perceptual realm is always changing. And no matter what energy we put in terms of expectations of how something might be or how something will be into creating that, by and large, it's not exactly the way we think it'll turn out. And this past experience of mine is, you know, a great reminder for that truth of unpredictability, that truth of uncertainty and almost, you know, almost a predictable sense that it won't be the way that you conceive of it happening. The reality is going to always be different in some way or another. And on a deeper level, actually, that same phrase, pointing to the fact that the conceiving mind is really just an abstraction of events, or an abstraction of perceptions into words and ideas and concepts, and that the actual real direct experience is altogether something different. So we have experiences, we have perceptions, and then on top of those, we layer this conceptualization, this abstraction, to help categorize the world and to frame it up in a way that gives us a sense of continuity, gives us a sense of security. If we can abstract our conditions into a conception, then we can easily point to that, draw that up, and use it to reinforce our need for this kind of sense of constancy, predictability. That's how we often use the conceiving mind. And we do that in a way that supports the perceptions that we want to believe in. We have certain values, certain notions that we think are right or just, or ways of being in the world, and we will look for ways to help support that. We will look for ideas and notions, thoughts that help contribute to keeping that world in motion, keeping that world predictable. In modern psychological terms, I think they call that confirmation bias, that you're constantly looking for something to confirm the reality that you want to believe in, ways to reinforce that and keep that going. So this is the way that we operate. And there's, you know, benefits to doing that, in that it helps to create a sense of a coherence, continuity in our perceptual realm. If we didn't have the ability to establish perceptions and ideas based on memory, then the world would be a real chaotic experience of input through the sense bases, feeling like kind of overstimulated, bombarded with all sorts of things if we didn't have a ability to kind of group experience and understand it through the perceptual process. But the downside is that the more we do that, and the more we use the conceiving mind to rationalize and support and create this ongoing perception of stability, that when it eventually changes, there's dukkha, dukkha arises because it's not fitting the pattern that we've invested so much time and energy into believing in and supporting and reinforcing and confirming. So most of those patterns are based, you know, with the forces of wanting, desire, aversion, confusion, delusion as the drivers, the steering mechanism for how we try to conceive the world and establish these patterns of perception that will give us a sense of security. And what the Buddha says is that, you know, if we want to transcend this, these patterns that just constantly keep on subtly fooling us into believing that it will give us, the ways we act on them and perceive the world will give us a sense of contentment and happiness. If we want to see through that delusion and the constant disappointments when it doesn't actually happen the way we expect it, then we do have this innate ability to restructure our patterns, restructure our conceivings, and to use the concepts and conceiving mind, the conceptual mind, to our advantage rather than being a victim of it. I think we all kind of operate as beings. We talk about artificial intelligence, and I think that that actually describes the human condition a lot. I think that a lot of our conceiving is artificial intelligence, just to prop up something from a deeper level. But I think that we can use this intelligence, we can use this conceiving mind to our benefit rather than being a victim of it under the control of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, we have this ability to use the mind to organize and explain and categorize different experience, and we can use words and concepts to store this information and retrieve it when we need to. And that's included in that is this idea of how to restructure our perceptual patterns and our conceivings in a way that's going to support wholesome mind states that lead us on the path rather than reinforce our desires, our aversions, in our general confusion. And that's by establishing and developing all of the factors that the Buddha has taught us that are going to be factors, skillful factors, wholesome factors that support our movement towards clarity and peace. This is right effort. The effort to abandon unwholesome states of mind and unwholesome tendencies, and the effort to establish and maintain wholesome states. And this is all through wise attention. Yoniso Manasikara is one of the factors of the mind that we can employ to put our attention on the mind, on our experience, on the world around us, in ways that are skillful, and using our intellect, our intelligence, to draw up these skillful qualities like wisdom and compassion and morality and generosity that produce different perceptual patterns, how we perceive the world, we'll do so in a way that will bring us a much longer-term sense of contentment and happiness and keep us moving on the path. So employing these mental abilities like wise, appropriate attention, and then practicing in that way, continuing to apply and look and see if what we're doing and how we're doing it is supportive, keeping us on the path of Dhamma, the path that the Buddha has talked about, the Noble Eightfold Path, as a way of leading to complete freedom. This is Dhammanu Dhamma Patipada, practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. So these two factors, Yoniso Manasikara, Dhamma Nidhamma Patipada, are the factors that we need to really develop and encourage to help break this habitual conceiving, perceiving paradigm that we mostly live through, that's based on the underlying tendencies of greed, hatred, and delusion. So we can use the same process, but substitute the factors of wisdom, wholesome mind states and wisdom, to redirect that whole process. Kind of thinking a little bit, moving along here into the end of the retreat, end of winter retreat coming up within a week. And even though I've just arrived here, I sort of have certain same kind of feeling from having been on the winter retreat at Amaravati as well. The momentum moving towards regular schedule coming up. There'll be movement of people, some people leaving, some people returning, coming back here, some visitors coming, the beginning of the engagement part of the year. Some of the retreat crew will be staying on, some will be moving on to whatever is next for them. And to just start to notice that process. And maybe spend a bit of time considering what it is that all of us, whether we're monastics or lay people, whether we're staying here or whether we're moving out to other places, other venues, to consider what will it take to keep the momentum going? What will it take to keep my focus, keep the focus on the long term, and to sustain a practice beyond the conditions of winter retreat? Very supportive conditions, less interaction, less activity, less stimulation from the outside, daily contemplations to help keep us focused, some periods of practice, some periods of group practice, some periods of solitude, all a very special time of year. And we need to have strategies for developing that kind of inspiration and commitment to keep it going, not to flag in our efforts. So to bring this up for consideration, what does it take to make this the long-term practice that it needs to be to realize the truth? The Buddha spent a lot of time with his teachings, and we are often reminded by many of our teachers that we should keep our intentions focused on the realization of the complete goal. We have this potential for complete ending of suffering, for the realization of the full fruits of the path, and not to get complacent with partial happiness, in a sense. We've often heard, don't be contented with just, mere happiness. There's a fuller freedom that's possible if we follow the path to completion. There's all sorts of benefits that come from virtue, generosity, simplification, all the factors along the path, the things that we develop. But the purpose of the teaching is to take us to the full understanding of the teachings. So how do we maintain that kind of momentum, that kind of energy, that kind of commitment that it takes? There's different strategies, but many of the teachings most of the teachings of the Buddha are strategies to realize the goal. It's not a system of beliefs that the Buddha says you must believe in this to realize the truth. You know, follow my way without having to think about it too much. Just have, you know, blind faith in the teachings. That's not the way he approached the teachings. And even with the factor of right view in the Eightfold Path, which is really a collection of fairly categorical teachings. A lot of his teachings were more instructive and urging contemplation and practice-oriented teachings. But the ones on right view also had this quality of being categorical, meaning that they helped define what it is that we're doing, keeping our eye on the goal. This is where he describes the fact that there are beings who are fully enlightened, fully free from dukkha. He describes in this right view the noble or the Four Noble Truths, the whole structure of the teaching, that what he teaches is suffering and the end of suffering, and that there are certain relative conventional truths that operate too, also like the law of karma. This is one of his categorical teachings, that there is cause and effect. With intentional action on body, speech, or mind, there's going to be some result. And this is what keeps us mired when greed, hatred, and delusion are in control, and also gives us the potential to work out of that through these factors that I talked about of wise attention and practicing in accordance with Dhamma. When those are employed, the law of karma will have its results, will have its fruits in terms of freedom, realization of the truth. So this is one of the categorical truths of right view. So bringing these up for reflection over and over again helps keep us on the path that we do have this possibility of transcendence. Sometimes that's a teaching that's left out of modern-day meditation centers, this teaching of transcendence. A lot of the teachings have come to the West with this notion of psychological well-being, stress reduction, you know, living a life that's a little bit more enjoyable, free from our neuroses. And this is all really good stuff, not to be belittled in any way and to be supported whenever it's expressed as why people are practicing. But for those who are ready, willing, and able to take it beyond that realm of conditions and point towards the unconditioned, this is the possibility. And this is what right view and reflection on right view, establishing ourselves in right view, that there is an ultimate goal that can be realized. And the consequences of not doing that is part of that right view too. This is where sometimes the, you know, in the West anyway, the quote unquote controversial teachings on rebirth can be very useful. The Buddha talks a huge amount in the suttas really about the endlessness, the vastness of samsara. And I think he brings this up as a major motivating force to keep us focused on the long term, exemplified in the account of his enlightenment, the night of his enlightenment, where he spends the first watch of the night reviewing his personal narrative, the countless, indescribably infinite number of past lives that he has lived, going back eons and eons and eons, even. The Buddha was not able to discern a beginning point of that. It's so vast. And then also the second watch of the night, where he was able to view this process happening to uncountable an infinitude of other beings being reborn from one life to another based on their karma. So it was these reflections in the first two watches of his night, I think, that gave him this motivation to make the breakthrough in the third watch of the night, where he saw the ending of the asavas, the ending of the outflows of the mind that produce rebirth in the endless realm of samsara, and his liberation from that. So liberation, freedom, nibbana, is pointing towards that ending of samsaric existence. That is an incredibly powerful motivation. I once asked a very senior teacher who I admire quite a bit and follow the teachings of quite a bit. I asked him once, do you think that people can enter the stream of Dhamma without having at least a reflective belief or a reflective interest in the notion of rebirth? And he was very thoughtful, and he thought, and he said, you know, he says, all the people that I know that have realized the noble attainments, I can't think of anyone that doesn't hold the notion of rebirth as a truth, even if they haven't experienced it or know it of themselves. That's something that has been a reflective acceptance. And then he also mentioned that he couldn't think of anybody who he knows that doesn't hold that, doesn't believe in the teachings of rebirth, or feels at least that they can't accept it because they haven't personally experienced it. He doesn't know that anybody that holds that particular standpoint who he feels has attained any of the noble attainments. Well, I thought that was a very powerful statement. And just to emphasize too that those teachings, all of the teachings, particularly on karma, rebirth, those things that sometimes Westerners have a bit of difficulty getting their minds around, and even monastics, there's some monastics who don't put a lot of faith in that, but that the Buddha's not asking or not suggesting in any way that it be accepted as a blind faith or a philosophical standpoint, that it must always be used properly as a contemplative strategy, as something to take as a working hypothesis if we don't know the truth of it for ourselves directly. And all of the teachings are this, in a sense, that it's a noble strategy see what the effects are. If we take this on as a possibility, what are the effects in the mind? And for myself, the notion of rebirth, as the Buddha talked about it in the first two watches of the night, I find that incredibly motivating to keep going for the long term, because there's so many ups and downs in the practice and so many ways to get discouraged. And if we don't have a notion that there's something that we can do to rectify that if we can stick with it long enough, if we don't have this kind of, if we think that it's all over just at the end of this life, or think that that's a possibility, then I can't see that there, and this other senior teacher couldn't see that there's the possibility of having the necessary motivation to get through the difficult times, to keep the focus, to keep the plot going, moving in the direction. The path is just, we're just so usually full of our own obstructions and difficulties that keep us from having the energy and the motivation if we didn't have this notion of the long term. So the short term benefits are there of the practice, luckily. You know, there's always the feedback that we get from all the benefits along the way, the insights, the successes, the short periods of peace of mind sometimes, and longer for others. There's all these short-term benefits along the way, but the long-term goal of complete freedom is something that we always have to keep fresh so that we don't get discouraged in the downtimes. I tell this story a lot, but I'll keep doing it because I find it very motivating, of the time when I drove, as an Anagarika, I drove Lumbar Pasano and Antanamaro down to Los Angeles for teachings of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at UCLA. And one of the most poignant moments was in the huge UCLA stadium. I don't know how many thousands of people there, but crowded, packed stadium. He was giving teachings over several days. And during one of the question and answer sessions, someone brought up, someone said, you know, you've been teaching us this path over the past couple of days, and it sounds so difficult, and it sounds so like it takes so long to realize the benefits of it. It can be a bit discouraging that it's so long and difficult as it sounds. Isn't there a faster, easier way to realize complete liberation, to realize the truth, the goal? And His Holiness went very silent, and after the whole stadium went completely silent, and after a few moments, you could see that he was wiping the tears from his eyes. And after another few moments, he said in a very, very lion's roar kind of voice, "There is no fast, there is no easy. If there were a faster, easier way to realize this path and the fruits, don't you think, out of compassion, that I would teach that to you?" So you could hear a pin drop when he said that. But that's always resonated in my mind and remains a very strong motivating force to come from such a, you know, a beautiful being as His Holiness. There is no fast, there is no easy. And the amount of effort that we have to put into staying with it. And to realize and to reflect again that also every bit and piece along the way, every minor insight, every sense of freedom, every confirmation of the validity of the path is one that brings a lot of happiness, a lot of joy. Even if we haven't completed the goal, we see gradually with increasing confidence that this is something that works. It takes effort, but it works. And then to take delight in our current day teachers, you know, the people that we spend time with, find inspiring in our tradition and other like traditions similar to ours, and to be with them, to spend time and to realize that it's been a path that's usually not been so easy for them either. But many of these people that we can admire have really realized fruits of the path and of the goal. And we can use that to inspire us and help keep us on the path too. This is association with wise people. And that factor, plus the factor of listening to the teachings, staying in touch with the path, not getting distracted. Those are the first two factors of needed for entry into the stream of Dhamma. And the other two factors that I was talking about earlier, wise, appropriate attention and practice in accordance with Dhamma, those are the third and fourth factors. So those four factors all together are what the Buddha talks about as the four factors to develop for entry into the stream of Dhamma. association with good people, wise people, listening to their teachings and the teachings of the Buddha, putting our attention on wholesome conditions, developing wholesome states of mind and wholesome ways of practice, the Noble Eightfold Path, and not getting distracted with other practices or traditions that lead us away from this path, practicing in accordance with the Dhamma, sticking with it. So to keep cultivating those, keep the mind moving in that direction, keep looking to the long term as we enter this transition period, moving back into more engaged times, moving on. But just a lot of encouragement to use what you've accomplished, what you've learned, what you've experienced the past 3 months, and to keep going. Don't turn back. So I'll leave that for this evening's reflections.